Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. I am Bob Enyart.
And I am Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
And Fred, you're also the webmaster for the esteemed Creation Research Society.
Yes, that's true. And today we're going to actually talk about a different magazine.
That's right. The Creation Magazine out of Australia. CMI, Creation Ministries International.
That's right, and their website is creation.com. Very easy.
What a great URL. Hey, Fred, in a couple minutes, I'd like to ask you about that Darwin film you guys showed at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship recently, but I want to jump right into news stories out of this Creation magazine. This is from May 2009, but Fred, also the big story, the science story this week is they found your great-grandfather.
Is that right?
No, your great-grandmother, Ida.
Ida, okay.
She's been missing for 47 million years.
They found another missing link?
Another? what do you mean another? They said this is it. They found the missing link.
Well, I don't know. Think back to the early 1900s. They found Piltdown Man, and that was the missing link.
That was the missing link.
That's right.
And then they found Nebraska Man?
Yeah.
That was the missing link.
That was a new missing link, and that was based off of a tooth.
They found one tooth on a farm in Nebraska. They built an entire jaw, then they built a skull, then a spine, then they built the whole skeleton, and Fred, then they built the whole society, including the tools that they used. They said it was Nebraska Man.
Yeah, and they had his wife to go with him, all out of a single tooth.
out of one tooth. But then they found the rest of the skeleton. It turned out to be a pig.
Yep, an extinct type of pig.
It was a pig. They found a pig. So they could turn a pig's tooth into a missing link. They always find the missing link.
That's right. And then they found, you know, of course, Lucy was the real popular missing link for many years. And then she kind of fell off the tree. And so now they have Ida that they're going to bow down and worship to.
Yeah. In fact, David Attenborough, the BBC evolution, he's been on the air for 50 years. I think he's bowing down and kissing her opposable big toe. That's what it seems like. It's just too much, Fred. And it's not 47 million years old. That would make this monkey older than the universe.
That's right. Because the universe is how old, Bob?
It's less than 10,000 years old.
That's right.
So anyway, and boy, do we got a lot of evidence to that effect on our website from Wednesday's show this week. Wednesday's show is called Link Missing 47 Million Years, and there is a lot of evidence against the millions and billions of year claims.
And I believe you have a quote on there from the scientist, Bob, or do you?
From Attenborough?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's saying that finally the missing link.
Yeah, they didn't have one before.
Yeah, he says now people can say, okay, if we're primates, show us the link. The link, they would have said up to now, is missing. Well, it's no longer missing.
Yeah, so we're 2009 and we finally have the missing link?
We didn't have it on Monday, but now we have it.
So I have a prediction I'd like to make.
Yes.
I predict in about 5 years that there'll be some new discovery that'll be the missing link that we've never had one before. Because this one will get refuted. Probably this one will be refuted in days.
Very possibly.
But by creation scientists, but it always takes the evolutionists, years, if not decades, to come around.
To correct.
That's right.
Yeah. They'll still be talking about the Piltdown Man.
Well, Lucy, they still have her human-like feet in museums. And there was one scientist, evolutionist, asked if the feet were realistic. And she said no. And then she was asked, well, should we remove them from the museum? And she said, absolutely not.
No, just because they're not real doesn't mean we shouldn't use it as propaganda.
Exactly.
Remember, they did a CAT scan of Lucy's skull, and they found something interesting about her inner ear. Because if you're an upright walker, your inner ear is oriented differently than if you go around on all fours and you jump around trees. And it turns out Lucy's inner ear is not oriented for upright walking.
That's right. And this isn't stuff that creationists necessarily discovered.
No, no. These are evolutionists who are saying, wait a minute, we didn't get any of that grant money. And look, and looky here. Okay, so Fred, Creation, the Creation magazine out of Australia, creation.com, this May edition, this is, I think, the best single edition of a magazine I've ever read, packed, jammed with science. But we did a couple shows on this issue so far, but we skipped the letters to the editor. And so maybe we could talk about some of these, like ancient atoms. There's somebody from Queensland, Australia, Michael, who wrote in and he had a question. Could you
share? Sure. He's asking about atoms, ancient atoms. He stated that Epicurus taught that the universe came about by a chance movement of atoms.
Epicurus, he's from B.C.,
yeah, and
right?
Like it says here, 341 to 270 B.C.
Yeah.
Do you think this is where the Epicureans came from?
Yeah, I think so. Few centuries before Christ. And so what is his question?
His question is, would Epicurus and the scientific philosopher community have known about atoms in their day?
Back then, centuries before Christ, why would Epicurus talk about the universe came about by atoms? And so the editor responds to Michael, even before Epicurus, in about 450 BC, Democritus proposed that all things are composed of tiny, indivisible particles, which he described as atomos.
And so now we know where the word atom comes from.
Atom, atomos. Democritus used this word, and you know, I studied Greek for a few years, Fred, and the prefix there, the alpha, the A, that's a negation, like not. Like a theist believes in God, an atheist does not. So our modern English word atom is derived from this, meaning not cuttable, indivisible. So he coined that term. And, of course, the creation editors say ancient men did not understand atoms as we do today. And, of course, we know that there are subatomic particles.
That's right, much more complex than they would have imagined, like the cell is much more complex than Darwin would have imagined.
Ever could have dreamed. And the atom is far more complex than we imagined just 40 years ago. I mean, we knew about protons, neutrons, and electrons, but these subatomic particles, and there are so many of them, and the further they go, they keep breaking it down into like a series of subatomic particles, and then they break one of those down, and there's another series, and they don't know where it will end.
Well, God's creation is interesting because as you look at it closer, as you go to the microscopic level, things start to get more complicated. Whereas if you look at one of our IC computer chips, you know, these things that the hardware engineers make that make our computers run, as you look at those chips, as you get closer microscopically to the insides of those chips, they get a lot simpler.
Yeah.
So God's creation is, you see more complexity as you look deeper into it.
And, you know, just as we look up into the universe and we see the glory of God and the enormous expanse of the solar system, the galaxy, and the universe, we see all that. But then as we look inward, we see how extraordinarily tiny these particles become, and mankind, we're like nicely situated somewhere in the middle. We could look in both directions.
Yeah, we truly are at the center of the universe. There's lots of evidence for that we've talked about in prior shows.
Yeah, it's just so much fun, and God's creation. You know, a neutron, if a neutron releases an electron, it becomes a proton. That's like a beta decay, a radioactive decay. And the most extraordinary things happen at the atomic, the subatomic level that you could have never dreamed, like photons, electrons emitting photons, and electrons grabbing photons.
And how it all holds together.
Oh, it's just
amazing.
Astounding.
God, well, speaking of small things,
yeah,
there's this article right after it about a small mouse.
The woodland jumping mouse, and from North America. And this mouse, this is written by Mac from New Brunswick, Canada. And Fred, he talks about this little jumper. What does this little mouse do?
Well, this is a, you know, it's a small mouse, about 3.5 inches, mm-hmm. and it's capable of jumping between 10 and 13 feet.
Whoa. Whoa. So that small can jump like 12 feet?
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because if when they compare it to when you extrapolate that to a 6 foot tall person.
Right.
He could jump 240 feet. That's about 80 yards.
Imagine you know, being on the Broncos.
I was going to say Shanahan. Well, not Shanahan anymore, but who's that new guy?
Well, say you hand off to your running back, and he just jumps from the goal line to the 20-yard line.
Yeah, if I could do that, man, I'd be the star of the league.
Yeah, you would. Forget about the NBA.
They'd have to find other jumpers to try to tackle me.
Yeah, right. And so anyway, that's just an example of the engineering brilliance in the creatures that populate the Earth's biosphere. It's astounding.
It is. I wonder how our wives would react if they saw a mouse jumping 10 to 12 feet throughout you know, the house.
I think Cheryl would jump higher. All right. So then there's another letter to the editor from New South Wales in Australia by Meredith. And she said she was watching this TV program about new inventors. And the winning invention was a zipper-like system which could be used to join all sorts of materials, Fred, not just the zipper, and it's not like Velcro. It's a different zipper-like system. And she points out something fascinating. What is it?
The inventor explained that while he was at the beach with his son, he was inspired by the way the muscles joined together.
Now, muscles, those creatures.
Yeah, not just someone's muscles. Yeah, the creature.
Right. Yeah, and so he looks at a little muscle, and he sees the way it's designed, and he gets an inspiration, and he invents a new kind of technique for connecting different kinds of materials. He wins the award for the best new invention, and Meredith says, maybe it's not new.
Yeah, exactly.
How could it be new? If God did this 6,000 years ago, this is the best 6,000-year-old invention. And she points out another of the five finalists took her inspiration from the way fireflies produce light. And once again, you know, God thought all these things up. And then we say, hey, that's a good idea. Maybe we could do something like that.
That's right. And man has constantly been trying to copy God's design throughout the ages. And unfortunately, a lot of times they're not giving God the credit. You know, for example, NASA with flying squirrels, they studied their aerodynamic system to try to improve the aerodynamic designs of the shuttle and other aircraft.
Yeah, maybe we'll get
there's
squirrels.
Many examples we could give you.
Maybe we could get the squirrels a little later in this show or next Friday's Real Science Friday show.
Okay.
But, Fred, you went to the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship's showing of that Darwin film. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, The Voyage That Shook the World. It was a very good movie, great graphics and just cinematography. And it traced Darwin's journey, you know, basically from England through down to, you know, the South America around mm-hmm. the Horn and up to where? The Galapagos Islands.
The Galapagos.
And it talked about a lot of the geologic features that he saw that he immediately attributed to millions of years. And throughout the film, there's commentary by various scientists, not all creationists. I think it was about a mix of half and half, commenting about how Darwin was wrong about so many things that he observed.
So many things, geologically, biologically. Yeah, just complete blunders, one after another. Not even mentioning the rare species that he told the cook to go ahead and kill it and cook it.
Yeah.
You remember that? We talked about that in a recent show. That was just one blunder out of so many blunders. In fact, one of the articles in this current creation magazine, Darwin's Imps of Darkness, this is so interesting. He went to the Galapagos Islands and he found this very unique creature. It's a marine iguana, and iguanas, they all live on dry land. This thing will stay underwater for 5-10 minutes or as much as an hour, and it will dive to 30 feet. And, you know, it blew his mind, and he said they were so hideous, he called them the Imps of Darkness. But this is the Imps of Darkness. But this is a great article by Tom Hennigan, and he's saying, forget hideous. These are really neat creatures.
Well, something that was pointed out in the movie, too, was that these creatures interbreed with some of the iguanas.
That are land iguanas. That's right.
And so this refutes the idea that these were, you know, they classify them as different species because they don't believe that they can interbreed, and they call that evolution.
Right, right. And it turns out they even have a photograph here of a hybrid from the marine and the land iguanas, the top one on the right column there. And so they do interbreed. They did come from one pair off of Noah's Ark.
Yeah, I think iguanas came from what?
What?
Iguanas.
Iguanas came from iguanas. That's right.
It's not a big surprise to us, but to evolutionists, they were surprised that this marine-born version of an iguana, this imp, could interbreed with a land version.
Right. And, you know, Dr. Walt Brown, I've been reading his book in the beginning, the 8th edition, fabulous book, and he shows the evidence that the continents were connected by land bridges and the ocean level went up a couple few hundred feet, and it ended up trapping all kinds of animals on islands where they used to be on peninsulas, and the Galapagos Islands is that same phenomenon happened there. And so in the centuries after the flood, some iguanas got trapped there, and it seems like early on after the flood, God designed species so that they could adjust to dramatic changes in their environment, the ecological influence on their own genome. And so these iguanas became marine iguanas, whereas the others, they just avoided the seashore.
That's right. There's genetic diversity, but there's a limit. There's a, you know, this iguana is not going to turn into my, you know, my dog. And then, you know,
right.
Even in millions of years, these things, you can talk to any farmer when the sheep breed, they get, you know, what happens? They end up with sheep.
They do?
Sheep turn into sheep. Iguanas turn into iguanas.
And how about the bacteria? They found bacteria in Antarctica. This is just in the last couple of weeks. And they said it's been trapped under the ice for 1.2 million years. And lo and behold, they could identify it. And it's the same species that they found in the past in the Arctic. So half a globe away, there's been no evolution
for millions of years.
And there have been how many? Now, these things, their population could double in 300 days. But how many actual generations in 1.2 million years? There'd be millions of generations and what? Virtually no change of the same species.
And unfortunately, this is one of the evolutionists' favorite ruses, is to use small-scale change, what they have termed microevolution, that they claim is evidence for large-scale evolution. They won't tell you that, hey, this is just minor adaptation.
Right.
And I believe, as the Bible says, they're being willfully ignorant, but this is one of their number one illusions that we need to watch out for, because you'll hear evidence of, here's another proof of evolution, and what all it'll be is small-scale change. I remember one that came out, I don't know, 2 months ago about the St. Bernard's head had changed shape over 100 years, and that was their evidence for evolution. My goodness. That's just, I mean, that's adaptability in the genome.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, if you look at the skulls of, say, women in Asia versus men in Italy, and you see a difference, we say, well, we must not be the same species. They must be evolving. I mean, these are just normal changes in normal ranges in Homo sapiens.
That's right. And just like, you know, with dogs, there's a normal range. I mean, you can go from a Chihuahua to a St. Bernard, and if there was a flood that buried these two animals, maybe along with a collie, then evolutionists would piece those together and say, look how this Chihuahua evolved into a collie, into a St. Bernard.
Yeah, they would say that, because they say that about Eohippus horses and... Yeah, they just...
And they'll say it about Ida that, you know, just came into the news.
Ida, the 2-foot-tall monkey that's your uncle.
They love to keep turning monkeys into men.
Yes.
But it's funny, I've got quotes about how they never find monkey fossils in the fossil record, like the great apes. They claim they don't have any record of the great apes in the fossil record. Well, there's a reason.
Because you keep turning them all people.
Yeah, you keep turning them into people.
Right. All right. So, but back to the film, Fred, you've been one of the leaders of the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship on and off for years. And so that group, which meets the second Friday night of every month, That group showed this video. Tell me, how was it?
Well, the video was great. We showed that at our last meeting, and one of the speakers in the video, one of the creation scientists, is Rob Carter. So it coincidentally...
He does population
stuff? He's a genetics, and I believe his specialty is population genetics, but I'd have to confirm that, but I'm pretty sure that's his line of work. Anyways, he's got a PhD, and he's going to be presenting to our group next month, which I believe is June 12th, Friday, June 12th.
June 12th, okay, 7 o'clock, where?
At Holly Hills, and it's on I-25 and Evans, roughly, Evans and Holly Street.
All right. And so we'll hear Dr. Rob Carter, who's a geneticist, and he's in this latest Darwin film.
He is, and we haven't had him here before, so I'm really looking forward to it. I think it'll be great.
That just sounds great. So thanks for reminding us about that. Now, if we can go to another story in our current Creation magazine, there's an interesting short article, a Gallup poll, talking about superstition and what kinds of people are superstitious and they believe in astrology or UFOs or clairvoyance. And there's something fascinating how this Gallup poll, it's a comprehensive new study, supposedly, and it compares irreligious people like atheists and agnostics and liberal Protestants like United Methodists. It compares them to Bible-believing Christians. And how does the comparison shake out, Fred?
Well, it shows that traditional Christian religion greatly decreases belief in everything superstitious, such as astrology, clairvoyance, UFOs.
Mm-hmm. The paranormal, the occult.
Yep.
And so a belief in God's word helped guard people against superstition. And they point out here, Creation Magazine says, hey, this is a brand new Gallup poll, but this isn't new. You go back 30 years and a Skeptical Inquirer study showed that the atheist college students were far more likely to embrace these kinds of views on the occult and, you know, all this, as compared to Christians. College students who were Christian were the least likely. And you know what Romans says? You've got a Bible verse there, don't you? Romans chapter 1?
Yeah, it mentions Romans chapter 1, verse 21 to 22, that people who refuse to honor God descend into futile thinking, and although they think that they are smart, they become fools.
Although they think they're smart, they become fools. Our youngest boys, Cheryl and I have seven boys, and the three young ones last night watched a video called Bible Man. And in it, Bible Man is fighting some evil guy, you know. And Bible Man quotes a memory verse from Proverbs, and he says, willfulness and stupidity should not go together. Don't let these two things go together, you know? It's going to hurt you. And I remember reading a book that I got from an engineer at McDonnell Douglas Helicopter Company. He was an atheist. He knew I'm a born-again Christian. I believe the Bible is God's word. And so he said, oh, I got a book you should read. And he gives me this book, Fred. It's about 900 pages thick. And it's called Extraordinary Popular Delusions in the Madness of Crowds. It's a classic, written by Charles McKay in 1841. And so I read the book cover to cover. Turns out I went to him after I read it to talk to him about it. He had never read it. And he thought that I would see that Christianity must not be true because this classic book exposes the absurdity of the masses. In that classic book, Fred, it was written by a Christian. Charles McKay was a Christian. He's now with the Lord, and his wisdom and discernment from God's word enabled him to write this extraordinary book exposing how stupid the masses will be.
Yeah. What did this friend think of that when you told him?
He was shocked that a Christian had written the book.
Well, you know, what's interesting about this same topic is I have a sister who's a pagan, totally unbeliever, and she thinks that she's seen UFOs. And I, you know, back when I was, I would consider myself fairly pretty carnal Christian in my youth, even then, I had the common sense to realize that, you know, if you have a certain worldview, if you've got this liberal point of view, you're more likely to believe in this silly stuff, you know, mm-hmm. alien abductions.
Yeah. Well, that's absolutely right. Yeah. You know, I didn't believe. I called a talk show. It was a Denver local talk show, and they were promoting alien abductions. You know, they believe this stuff. And they asked the question, a trivia question, like, was it 3 pilots, 5 pilots, or 9 pilots that saw this one UFO? And I called in and said, it was 9 pilots. And they're like, oh, yeah, how'd you know, you know? And so I said, you know, I didn't believe in alien abductions until just about 3 weeks ago. And it happened with my cousin. And so now we've got this, you know, the whole family's talking about it. And they asked me all the details. And as I was revealing the details one by one, I told them, you know, we can't, it's hard to figure out what to feed it. And they're like, well, what are you talking about? And I said, well, my cousin abducted this alien and he's got it in his barn and we don't know what to feed it. And, you know, they totally believed my story. They would have added it to their database of all the abductions.
Did you get a call from Steven Spielberg?
I wish. Well, on page 8 of this Creation magazine, there's an article about, you know, extraterrestrials versus miracles. And they talk about an article in New Scientist. New Scientist, that's a evolutionist magazine, right? New Scientist?
Yes.
And it's about SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, S-E-T-I. And they interview this SETI researcher, Seth Shostak. And he was asked, why do you think intelligent extraterrestrials exist? And do you have his answer? Are you on that page?
Yeah. He said, to believe that they don't exist requires positing that what's happened on Earth is some sort of miracle.
Right.
I find that premise a tougher sell than to think that intelligence is a fairly frequent development in a 14-billion-year-old cosmos.
Yeah. Now, so he's saying, well, I have to believe in evolution. Otherwise, there was a miracle on Earth. And so that's what motivates them, and they act like they are above bias, you know? Oh, we are objective evolutionists.
And they're just consciously rejecting the truth.
Yeah, and they should be able to acknowledge their bias and say, we interpret everything based on our resistance to God. It's God that we object to. And so when the evidence is staring them in the face, the extraordinary sophistication of DNA, which has sophistication at multiple levels. We're just even now beginning to scratch the surface.
Well, mentioning DNA, it shows intelligence, it shows information, and this whole thing about extraterrestrials and SETI, well, Search for extraterrestrial intelligence. They had a movie called Contact that Carl Sagan mm-hmm. wrote a book about, and they made a movie about it called Contact. And Jodie Foster was a scientist, and she discovers this code from outer space.
This
it was a series
code,
of prime like, numbers.
Bleep, bleep, bloop, bleep, bleep, bloop, bleep, bleep, bloop.
Yeah. That was And she hears this, and it was a series of prime numbers, and she goes, oh, this cannot happen by natural chance.
This can't happen by chance. It's got to be intelligent
and so
life.
They've got a double standard. They'll call that science, which it is science. I mean, if you've got a signal, if you got information, you know that you've got intelligence behind it.
Right.
But they won't apply the same standard to things like DNA, where
which is so
clearly
much more wildly sophisticated,
far more
than
wildly
a few prime numbers.
Exactly.
It's like when they thought there was a face on Mars. There's a few hills, and they thought, well, that had to be made by intelligence. But an actual human face, they think that happens by accident.
Yeah.
Thank you, Fred Williams. May God bless.
Thank you.
You.